Blog Talk Radio.
Sister Kim Weston, the Black National Anthem.
The present has grown.
Difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Drive-On's Connection. This is Antoinette, and tonight I have a guest with me. Well, as a matter of fact, I have two. Vincent Berry, he's honoring Norman Whitfield and Miss Kim Weston, and this is the part one of our segment, and I have Miss Kim Weston with me. Miss Kim, you with me?
Can you hear me, dear?
Yes, I can. You're loud and clear. Yes, Miss Kim?
Yes,
you're clear.
Hello?
Miss Kim?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. You're loud and clear.
Okay, and Vincent is here.
Oh, he's with you. Okay.
Yes, okay.
How are you?
Hello, how are you? I was looking for your number. I was like, okay, he's not here yet.
Yeah,
okay,
I came
great.
Over to deal with
him. Great. All right, well, I'd like to present to y'all Vincent Berry, and his mentor was Norman Whitfield. And he has a lot of things to tell us about his journey and just his first meeting with Miss Kim, well, not actually meeting her, but seeing her and the impact that it's made on his life and the impact that Norman Whitfield made on his life as far as saving his life in a sense. So, well, Vincent, do you want to give us your story?
Well, yes, Antoinette.
Tell us
thank
how
you
met Miss Kim. Pardon me?
I didn't understand what you said.
Oh, I said, you want to tell us how you met Miss Kim?
Yes. I actually met Miss Kim through a friend of mine named Jeff Stanton, who's the leader of the group that I was working with out of Detroit named Dream Boy. He was one of Kim's students in the summer festivals in Detroit. It was the summer school performing arts festivals in the city of Detroit, but with that Kim put together with the city, Mayor Coleman Young, and she had a lot of the Motown alumni and different people that used to come by and come and mentor the kids. And they used to work, they called it the work program. And, you know, it was one of those work programs that the kids actually got paid to come learn, you know, and come play music and learn. It was a youth summer youth program. So Jeff Stanton, my friend, he's my best friend, he was explaining to me what that meant to him when he was 16, 14, 16, whatever, how old he was then. And me, coming from Bay City, Michigan, which is hour and a half away from Detroit, we didn't get that kind of programs in our city, especially our town was only maybe 2% black. So you can imagine what I was coming up with and hearing my friends coming up with having Motown and people like that as their mentors, okay?
Yeah.
So that's how I met them through him. And But that's not the first time that I saw Kim. The story goes, it's me and my mother and I moved to California when I was young, like about 7 years old, 6, 7 years old,
mm-hmm.
from Michigan, and we stayed there for a while. And then in 72, August, before we came home, me and my cousin Tonda and my cousin Tina Walker. Tina's my age. We were 10 years old. And we go to the Wattstax Festival in Los Angeles. There was a group by the name of the Dramatics had a new lead singer in their group named L.J. Reynolds, who happens to be very close to us from Saginaw. So my cousin wanted to see, she's our chaperone. She wanted to go see the show, so that's how we got to watch that. And she took us there.
Yeah.
And our grandmother, we were shocked that she let me and Tina go because we were only 10. you know, going to something big like that, and we had no idea. We've never seen these many black people in our life. I mean, in one spot. It was over 100,000 people at the L.A. Coliseum. No fight, no nothing, no trouble, just straight fun. Here we are at 10 years old in this audience, and we witnessed history that night, that day. And that history was we were standing in that audience with our fists held high in the sky with our afros, just like Jesse Jackson, saying, I am somebody. And we kept saying, I am somebody. And then they said, ladies and gentlemen, singing the black national anthem, Lift Every Voice, Miss Kim Weston. And we sit there and heard that for the first time in our lives. And that whole experience gave me such a high, as I want to call it, as people that might do drugs, whatever, say, I was on a high. And I was already into music trying to play, but I didn't really understand at that age. But when I left that concert seeing Kim, seeing the Staple Singers, seeing Isaac Hayes, the Bar Kays, Rance Allen Group, it was so many of them there at the time that Rufus Thomas, I never forget Rufus Thomas because I used to love the dog. I used to do the dance, me and my, the Get Down Children, the Breakdown Children. Me and my little cousin Tina, we were known to be dancers in our family, and they used to make us get up in front of everybody and do that dance. And we was out on that floor, on that field that day, doing that song. The Breakdown Children, Rufus Thomas was, he had this outfit on that was just outrageous. I never forget that. Purple and white. And it was, he had shorts on with high white socks. It was the funniest thing you ever see in your life. But he turned the place out. You know, and he was probably the oldest performer there. So we had an experience all day at Watch Stack. Me and my cousin. In front of, I didn't want to come back to Michigan no more. I didn't want to do it. I said, when I go back to Bay City, it was going to be 95% white folks. And I have nothing against white folks, but I was happy to see this black history that we missed. So being there meant the world to me and my cousin. And that's, we're going to talk about that on my show May 1st. And we're going to show that piece because we're going to be honoring Kim that night, because how this story ties together, by me, no one knowing, God is the only one that knew it, that I was in that audience watching Kim singing that national anthem and not really knowing how valuable and how much it meant to us as black people. It was very, very touching. But also, it touched my life musically. That's when I got the bug to say, I want to be a drummer. I got to be a drummer. And just some little more flavor to you that I didn't tell you the other day, the gentleman, the congo player for Isaac Hayes in that audience just died. He had his funeral today, matter of fact.
Oh, wow.
His name was Jerry Jones, okay? Jerry Jones just sold me the congas. He sold them to me 3 years ago. He lived with my cousin, and he was sick. And he sold me those congas that he had on that show. I have them in my basement right now. I play them all the time in my show that I do. And I have that as a piece of, camaraderie or historic value that this man gave me. And Jerry played with Marvin Gaye and Isaac Hayes. Those are the two he played with the most. And I have congas that was actually in that audience at Watch Stack. I couldn't believe it. And no one probably would ever believe me, but I don't care because God made that happen.
That's right.
I feel bad today because I was supposed to go to his memorial, and I didn't make it earlier today. You know, his name is Jerry Jones. In Detroit, okay? So this is special to me. So knowing back to Kim and knowing Jeff, to meet Tim, and then I meet Norman Whitfield, not knowing all this stuff. I didn't know Norman did Tim's first record.
That's what you opened the show with.
That's what you opened the show with. It should have been me. Now, I did know that Norman worked with Mickey Stevenson because when we were together, he put me in front of Mickey Stevens on several occasions. So now Mickey knows who I am. And I cherish those things, what Norman did for me. Norman did a lot. I have so much, but I'm not going to tell everything because I want people to go get the book. Okay?
So now what you got to do is let them know who Norman is.
So now I got to listen to Miss Kim, and we got to tell the world who Norman is. Well, Norman is the producer, was part of the first three, or the architects of Motown sound, which we know was Hollanders of Holland, Smokey Robinson, Norman Whitfield, and Barry Strong. Okay, those are your three. Then you got a whole bunch of more after them who created the same. I can't even name all the rest of them, but everybody knows what follows, that follow that bunch. And those first three who created that sound and created the life of Motown just brought all these other people to Motown, and they always had great writers and producers all the time. It was the team effort. Competition breeds champions is what Norman taught me. And he always told me, Benny, you were underdog like I was. I had to fight like hell. I was up against Howlin' Dozier Holland and all the other ones. Matter of fact, Eddie Holland was his first writing partner that wrote The Girl's All Right With Me, Girl, Why You Want to Make Me Blue, and, of course, the famous Ain't Too Proud to Beg, okay, which took it on to a whole nother thing.
Tell us some of the other songs Norman did, like Great Band.
Then Norman would come at to with when he brought his partner Barry Strong in from 1966 to 1973, especially when Holly Dozier Holland left, Norman kind of held Motown together with the Temptations' flurry of hits for 7 years. And Marvin Gaye's hit was Gladys Knight hit. I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Everybody knows that. Norman, matter of fact, I really wanted to do something with the Heard It Through the Grapevine because I have a song that I got that Norman did with me, and it's he sung I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And it's a whole different version, and you would never believe Norman would be singing. That's a jewel that I'm keeping for the book and for some other things, but I did have to speak about it because I Heard It Through the Grapevine was a very big signature song. Okay, now he also had the first Motown Grammy that the Temptations performed, Cloud Nine. That was the first Grammy that Motown received by a duo group, but it was written by Barry Strong and Norman Whitfield. He also wrote I Wish It Was Rain with Roger Pinsent-Bean and Baird, of course, and he did Psychedelic Shack. He did Just My Imagination. He did Ball of Confusion. He did War. Smiling Faces by the Undisputed Truth. Too Busy Thinking About My Baby with Janie Bradford. I could go on and on. A million album cuts. Tell you something that's really interesting that he used to always be proud of, that he told me. Well, Vinny, before I had all them monster hits, I probably had more regional hits than anybody. Talking about Jimmy Ruffin. Jimmy Ruffin was a regional hit maker more than anybody. His records were huge in the regions, you know, smaller regions that created hit records. It may not have been pop, it may not have been that, but they were hit records. Proud of that. Very proud of those type of accomplishments that he created on his own. When I won't say on his own, he had teams. You know, Motown was a team of writers and producers that sit in a room, and, you know, you had to be on top of your game or you wasn't getting that single release the next time. And that's how he got to Temptations, is with him and Eddie Holland's song, Ain't Too Proud to Beg. It outdid get ready. Okay? And when that happened,
yes,
then they came right back. Him and Eddie came back with Judy's Only Skin Deep. Okay? Now, after those things happened, Eddie left. For whatever reason, they were gone. Norman had to bring somebody with him to get his lyrics right or an arrangements right. And he brought back Barry Strong, the guy who created the song Money with Janie and Barry, or who, however that was supposed to go. Because, of course, I wouldn't know that, but we do know the story. That was the first record that I think was the first hit for Motown or something of that nature. And he brought back, Barry had left. And when Norman had no lyricist like Eddie anymore working with him, he did lyrics himself, but he was a perfectionist. He wanted to make his stuff the best lyrics that he could. And if he came up with a lyric that wasn't too right or didn't fit Barry Gordy's psyche or mind, if it wasn't a certain thing, if it was just too this way or too that way, it got scratched. So he would always go to the Brian Hollins and the Eddie Hollins and the Mickey Stevensons and different people he wrote with through his years there and grab the best that he had, okay? But Norman was a perfectionist as a producer, and he was proud of this stuff. I mean, he was a no-nonsense character, a little bit edge hard sometimes. Used to go to Down There Blows with Marvin and Dennis Edwards, his two favorite singers, and Gladys. He shared a lot of this with me before. We were writing his book together, and we were doing things together that created these different things and coming up with the message to his madness, is what was a song later on that he created for Undisputed Truth at Whitfield Records. This was after he left Mo. I have a lot of knowledge with him, and because he spent so many days with me making sure that I understood what I was talking about, because he didn't want me to have the wrong scenario and wrong understanding of who he was. And my book, it's not all about just Norman and his production and what he did like most people just want to hear. I'm going to be talking about the man that he was inside, the man that I watched come and, I call it, save my life. But he saved me within the music industry, because he seen something coming at me that he knew that I couldn't handle, because I was told green, and that was this. And I'm going to get that out the bag, but I'm not going to go any further, is that I wrote a record that became number one in pop and R&B, and I end up having to sue for that record because I didn't get my credit. But I was green. I didn't know. I didn't know what was going on. Yeah. I just went after the record. But it got big, got huge. The lawsuit got huge, and things happened. And Norman pulled me to the side and said, boy, do you know what you're doing? And he said, of course you don't know what you're doing, because you ain't never had a hit record in your life. He said, but you know how powerful and what you're doing that could affect you down the way? I said, no. He says, you need to do something about this, because when you have a hit record, there's a machine behind that hit record, and you ain't the only one getting paid. There's a whole bunch of people behind that record that made that record what it was. Now you're going to sue somebody. Now you just stopped a whole bunch of people's money. Because when you do that, you stop everything. They put a cease and desist on everything till the courts figure out what they're going to do, who's going to win what, and who's going to what. Well, when you So when you're dealing, I didn't know this stuff. Of course I didn't know.
I didn't know it either.
Well, a lot of people don't know that. But he pulled me down and said, Vinny, you're going to have to come work for me. He said, I'm going to save you from getting yourself caught up in a situation in the music industry that may not do you well for the rest of your life. And that's what I mean by him saving my life. Even though I also end up knowing down the road Norman wanted somebody. He wanted to be back in the game. He wanted to be around musicians. He used to love ear hustling people. And that means, Vinny, I just want to go sit down in the studio and sit there while you do your thing. Because he liked what I was about and liked what I was doing. Now, of course,
yeah.
when he got in that studio, he wasn't quiet like he was supposed to be. He ended up taking over the whole floor, and we've been hearing about all his stories in the session. I said, Norman, I'm paying for the session. You know, don't worry about it. I got it. And he'd take all night, and then he'd pay me later on his day to go take some studio time and come back tomorrow. So he's there for me all the time, sharing his life and sharing his techniques and skills in studio with me and my producers and my writers and talent. One of those talents was Teron Brooks, the guy who played Eddie Kendricks of The Temptations. Now, how ironic is that?
In what?
In The Temptations.
So Eddie Kendricks wasn't his real name?
His name is Teron Brooks. And I'm flying him in for my show May 1st to be a surprise guest for the Detroit audience.
Oh, okay.
He'd never been to Detroit, and he represented Eddie Kendricks really good in that story.
Yeah.
So Norman had a chance to get with me. He said, Vinny, I want to work with that boy. We had no idea he was going to get the part. But we thought we was going to give him a helping hand, because when I found out, I was managing the kid at that time. He was just a young kid. But I wasn't handling his acting career. I was doing all his music stuff. I'm the one that put him in the music, put him in the studios, and started teaching him certain things. And he's a phenomenal guy now. He's just awesome. And Norman used to watch me with him and say, Vinny, you're going to have trouble because he ain't no hardcore rat like what's going on today. In the 90s, there was a lot of hardcore rappers and singers coming out saying all the nasty stuff. Teron was not that. Teron was said to me by God, basically, because the guy gave me hope to come back to God himself. He was a spiritual guy. So I was trying to figure out how to work this kid and get him into the mainstream and get him not people wanting him to talk about getting the girls' draws, because that wasn't what he's about. And Norman said,
right.
I know just what to do with it. You know, Eddie Kid, just before he got to the movie, you know that song, Just My Imagination, we're going to do that song on him. We never got a chance to do the song on him with Norman. Norman ended up doing that on my team. Yes, because we didn't get a chance to do it on Teron. Next thing you know it, we look up, and we used to see Otis all the time. Me and Norman used to go visit Otis and Richard Street all the time. And Otis was talking about the movie. And he was like, hey, man, it's this kid that we looking at. And it was Teron. And I go, hey, man, I manage that kid. Oh, well, you do? I said, well, I don't do his acting stuff. I do his music stuff. He's in the studio, and then Norman Bob said, yeah, I know Teron, too. He said, matter of fact, man, he's a good kid, man. This is what you need to do, Otis. Give that boy a break. We went to a concert, me and Norman, with Smokey. He did this for me. He said, I'm only going because I know you want to see everybody. You want to meet all the most. That was your dream, to meet. Oh, I'm going to introduce you to everybody you want to meet. So we went to Smokey's concert. Otis was there. Susan was there. They all was there. And they used to support their artist, Motown did, in droves. And Smokey was one of them. Everybody was at his show. You need to go to the back room. Everybody's there. So to celebrate. Me and Norman go to the concert.
So the back room is like a party?
Like a party, right. All the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so Norman hadn't been around those people in like a while. But for me, he said, I'm going to take you. And then we know Teron is up for that movie. I'm going to take you over there. We're going to go over there and see. We didn't go backstage, none of that. He went and gave me the money to go buy me front show row tickets, because we support our people. Vinny never asked for free tickets. I don't need that. Let's go, blah, blah, blah. We didn't know we was going to be rich like this. Please tell us. He said, but I'm the same guy I was back then. So we get the tickets, and we're sitting on the front row, like maybe not front row, like 10 rows back. Smokey, we're late. Smokey's up there performing, and Smokey sees us walk up to go get our seat, and he noticed Norman. And right after he sung that song, he said, I got a special guest in the audience that I haven't seen in a long time. He said, Mr. Norman Whitfield, would you please stand up?
And oh,
Norman
wow.
is this guy, and Norman is this guy that's really real. He didn't care who it's from. He was like, oh, man, I ain't standing up, man. This is your show. And then when he stood up, he pulled me up to stand up with him. I said, no, he didn't ask me to stand up. He said, you with me. Shut up. Just stand up. The Smokey ain't never met me. He was like, stand up, boy. You with me. So I stood up with him. He was like, okay. So that was the first time I seen Smokey face to face. And then after the show, of course, they came and got us. Susan had somebody come get us, and we went backstage. We went to the green room, and Susan, being Susan, and, you know, she's a famous person. You know, she's on her stick, you know. She says
yeah.
to me, okay, she says to me, come on, Vinny. I'm going to take you to the green room. We get you something to eat and some drinks, blah, 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 and I'm going to take Norman, blah, 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 blah. And so I went on where she told me to go. And Norman's just standing there. And he didn't leave. He just looked at her. I could not believe what he said. He said, Susan, what you doing? He said, I ain't changed. She said, what, Normie? He called him Normie. Well, what you mean, Normie? I ain't changed. Vinny is my vice president of my company. He don't sit in the green room. He go everywhere I go. That's what he told Susan to pass. And I said, for me? No way. He said, for you, Vinny. So come on, let's go back here. You said you want to meet Smokey. You said you want to meet Bear. You want to meet all these people. Now we're going to go meet. When I got inside that room, Smokey, Harvey Sucre, Stevie, I should name them all, the ones that were still around, okay? That's when I met Janie Bathurst for the first time, who was very funny and very live, and I loved her to death because her and Norman got stories. But when he introduced me to Smokey, he introduced me with this crazy story, and Smokey turned red like he wanted to kill Norman. I said, oh, my God, I can't believe it. He said, yeah, Vinny, this is the guy I took the Temptations from. I said, what? And that's when he told me the story about Ain't Too Proud to Beg outselling Getting Ready. He said, competition breeds champion. So he know the deal. He said, I won that one, Vinny. And I didn't lose for 7 years. Nobody could steal them from me, Vinny. And Smokey was like, Norman, you ain't changed a bit. He said, man, we didn't know we were going to be rich like that. I mean, they had me in tears laughing about their love for each other and their competition. The only people who wasn't there at that time, I didn't meet Eddie Holland and those guys at that time. They weren't there at that time. I met them later. But I wanted to meet them.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, he asked me who I wanted to meet, and I told him. Barry wasn't there at the time. He had to go with something, but daughter got missed something. But Norman ends up taking me to Barry's house in Bel Air. That was a
thing. Oh, wow.
So I'm going to leave the rest of my book, okay, because there's a whole bunch. But I felt that that was important to tell, the fact that Norman kind of pulled me to the side when that lawsuit happened. And in the book, you'll hear more details of what really went on and why Norman came and said to me, come here, boy, I got a job for you. You're going to be rich if you mess with me. At the end of the day, you're going to be rich. I got something for you to do. But before he passed away, I will say this. Huh?
No, no, no. Go ahead. Please, finish your talk.
Before he passed away, I'll tell you this. He left me with the Four Tops last album with all original Four Tops people together that I worked on with him. And I did a presentation to Levi and those guys when they passed the torch to the new lead singer, Theo Peoples, at the time. And Norman had to change the music again, just like he did when David Ruffin left the Temps. And he had to bring in Dennis Edwards. The same kind of vibe. There has never been another lead singer for the Four Tops ever at this point. So their sound was always Levi.
Yeah,
it was a rougher challenge for Norman doing that than it was during the Temptations. And he had a time with it. But out of that, he wrote a song to God that is awesome, that I had the opportunity to do some things with him on. And I cherished the moment. And then he produced my son and wrote for my son, the last person that he was ever in the studio with. It was my little boy, 12 years old. So he told me I had something for you. And it was about, he had demo songs that he wanted to release in the project that he was singing himself. He did something different. Instead of me going to get Joe Pep to do all the demos, Joe Pep used to be his man. And when they sung all them songs, Papa was a Rolling Stone, all the undisputed truth, Joe Pep was doing them before anybody did. Because Norman was working with him all the time.
Yeah, I had Papa was a Rolling Stone and Ain't Too Proud to Beg. You mind if we play one?
Let's do it. I got to take a bathroom break anyway, okay? Because, you know, I get excited so y'all can take a lot of I get on the roll, you ain't going to stop me. But my friend is here with me, and she's looking at me crazy. And don't tell it all, boy. You know.
We want you to tell it all.
No, okay, she don't want me to tell it all yet. I've been told you, you'll be here for 5 hours messing with me. Okay, let's take a break because I got to go to the restroom.
Okay.
Walk with me. Take my hand.
the 3rd of September. That day I'll always remember. Yes, I will. Cause ever the day that my daddy died, I never got a chance to see him. Never heard nothing but bad things about him. Mama, I'm depending on you. Tell me the truth. Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. Papa never was a day in his life.
And Mama, some bad talk going around town saying that Papa had 3 outside children and another wife. And that ain't right.
Heard some talk about Papa doing some storefront preaching. Talking about saving souls and all the time leeching. Stealing in debt and stealing in the name of the Lord. Mama just hung her head and said,
okay, folks, I'm sorry. That was the long version, and we're going to get back to our interview with Brother Vincent. Okay, Vincent, you back with me?
I'm back with you.
Okay, I have a question about that song, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Now, from what I read years ago or heard in an interview, that was the time of when the lead singer that had to sing that song, his father had just died to do that song, and he didn't really want to do it because a lot of that song really hit close to the way how his father was, and he just didn't want to do that song, but he was forced to do it. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. That's untrue.
Okay.
That scenario that you're talking about was made for the movie. Twisted for the movie. Dennis Edwards' father actually died in October.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And it's just so ironic that it was the third day of October. Norman said it was the 3rd of September. And he had no problem singing the song. The problem with the song and what was going on that they said was a problem is that the Temptations themselves was looking for another ballad, like Just My Imagination. They were looking for ballad songs. And Norman was on his psychedelic soul type stuff, and he made him wait a long time to deliver Papa Was a Rolling Stone. And they thought they were going to get a ballad, and they got that. But they didn't mind because it was an instant smash, but it was a remake. Because Undisputed Truth had it first, and it went to number 45. It was a regional hit.
Oh.
So Joe Pepp and Undisputed Truth sung the song first.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a recut for the Temptations. Just a different version that Norman went back in the studio and did a different arrangement. Very similar arrangement, but Paul Reiser did the arrangements and stuff, and Norman mixed it and all, and, you know, and then it became that long version. Norman was into doing his long versions and long his instrumentation, you know, and that's basically the story. You know, from what I was told from Norman himself, you know, that was it. So the story that you hear and most people hear, they think
not
that
true.
Because the movie that was made for TV, so they used that part as a way to create excitement for the movie and for the scene. Because, and that's what I was told about that. But yeah, I'll tell you something that ties into Norman about September 3rd.
Okay.
When Norman was in the hospital on his deathbed.
Oh, no.
It was September 3rd. And he flatlined. We were all at the studio, all the people that were there. We're at the studio. He flatlined earlier that day with somebody, with one of his friends. Renee was there. Her name was Renee. She was there. And another guy was there named Dwayne Moody was also there. And I was the other guy. I came after it happened. And what happened was Norman, when he flatlined, he came to and he pulled the wires out of his mouth and said, "Hey, where's Vinny? Go get me a hamburger. I'm tired of eating this crazy food." That's what
happened. He came back and wanted food. He was hungry.
But that was on September 3rd. And I think it was Joe Pepp. I think it was Joe Pepp, if I'm not mistaken, because I don't want to put – I'll never put nothing bad out on anybody, but Joe has never said nothing crazy anyway. But I do think it was Joe who – got word from somebody that Norman passed. And people were going around saying, "Norman died on September 3rd, just like the record." But no, he was in there eating McDonald's hamburgers and all kinds of stuff. And the doctor came in the room and said, "Leave him alone. He's not well. He probably won't make it." He pulled him out. He pulled the stuff out of his mouth. Norman lived for 16 more days, 13 more days.
Oh,
he died on September 16th. All they did was instead of taking him home and all that, the doctor put him up in the in Cedars-Sinai in a closed, private situation, and that's where he ended up passing away. You know, but it wasn't September 3rd, but it was definitely what I just told everyone, it was definitely that going on. And Janie Bradford came up there that night, and First Lady of Motown, Miss Robinson, was there that night. It was a bunch of folks there that night. And we just, you know, well, like I said, he lived on for 13 more days. So everybody was having fun with him, you know. And just, he was back. It was like almost he was back to life. And he kept telling me, Vinny, get me out of this bed and take me home. I want to die in my own bed. Take me home, man. And he put his foot out on the ground. I said, man, you know you can't walk. Put his foot out there with that old little skinny leg. And come get me, take me home, Vinny. Man, I ain't taking you out of this hospital. You know, but that's, I thought I had to share that because it was a funny moment, but it was a real moment. It was a real moment.
Yeah.
You know.
Did he make songs for Motown or was it for another label?
No, it was all that stuff you're talking about was from Motown from 1961 to 1973. And then he left Motown and started Whitfield Records, and that's when he had a hit with the group Rolls Royce, and it was Car Wash, the Car Wash soundtrack. And
yeah.
He won a Grammy for that and an Oscar, I think.
Oh, wow. Because it was made into a movie. And they had had the Pointer Sisters, Richard Pryor.
Oh, he wrote all that. He wrote everything on that album was Norm. Everything.
Oh.
Pointer Sisters, you got to believe in something. Why not believe in me?
Yeah. And the lady who sang...
I'm Going Down was on there, yeah.
Yes. Now, she recently had a stroke. Well, maybe not too recently, but I had heard that she had a stroke.
Who's that?
The lady that sings I'm Going Down.
Oh, the lady that sings Going Down is Gwen Dickey from Rolls Royce. And
yes.
I don't know if she had a stroke, but she did get, she lives in London now. And,
she had,
I don't know if it was a stroke, but I thought she had fell at one of her concerts or something like that. And she's in a wheelchair now.
Yeah, I heard she was in a wheelchair. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but I thought I was told that she had a stroke. But, I mean, I could be wrong. I said, I thought I was told that she had a stroke. I said, but, of course, I could be wrong.
And I don't know the complete story. I thought she had fell or something like that. Yeah. Mhm. So I do know that now. She was a very, very cool person. And in the hospital, I got her on the phone. I talked to several people on the phone, connecting them to Norman while he was in this hospital way. And Gwen was one of them, and Norman was a sight. That was a sight there. He was so happy to talk to Gwen. You could see it light up all his face. He thought he was going to get up out that bed and walk out. And the same with Barrett. When I got Barrett on the phone, he lit up. And I got Jimmy Ruffin on the phone. This is before Jimmy Ruffin died. He lit up. You know, and Gladys came to the hospital to see him, and so did Barry.
Oh.
Those were big moments. And Joe Pep, of course, came, and Wawa Watson. Wawa Watson is not with us no more either. And one of his main guys that worked with him. And Joe Pep came, him and Renee, and that was a powerful scene, powerful sight, because that was his best friend. Joe was a good friend of his, and they hadn't seen each other in a while. And Joe showed up, and that was so good for Norman to see his friend before he left us.
I'm going to bring someone. I'm going to bring someone on that I told you that I wanted you to meet. That I wanted to introduce you to together.
Okay.
So, without any further delay, Brother Ray.
Well, good evening,
Brother
Jeff.
Ray.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, Miss Kim is well.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Listen, gentlemen, Vincent, I've just been listening for a while, and I'm just so glad that you're speaking out and speaking up. Your word doesn't get down here. I'm in Miami, Florida. I was very close friends with Betty Wright, who introduced me to Gwen Dickey right before she got started. We became great friends, and I've spoken to her in the last year or so. She is in London. She is in a wheelchair. She did have a stroke. She did fall. That's about all I know, but I know that she was a great, great singer, and I'm grateful to hear them playing some of her music now, and they're bringing back a lot of the good songs that were made in that era, and I'm just grateful that to hear you and your input to that era, because we missed that era. That era, you know, we need to really do something to bring it back, brothers. We need to step it up. They're changing everything, but they can't change that soul that you guys brought to the industry. And I'm just glad that Antoinette brought you in to share that with us.
By way of Ms. Kim, by way of Kim Weston.
I'm very thankful for God and for Kim and Antoinette bringing me to this situation, because I've been waiting to tell the story that I've got about Norman, to uplift Norman and his people that he worked with over the years. And it was such a blessing for them, me be able to meet Kim and come into this. And like I said, none of the people, my friends, nobody knew that I was going to say, do you guys know I was in that audience watching that lady sing that song? I was 10 years old. I'll never forget it. The people, my own mother don't even know it like that. I tell her, my mother, she look at me and say, oh, no, you just full of shit. You know, oh, you know what you're talking about. You're going 10 years old. Oh, yes, I do. And my cousin was a witness with me, because she says it too. She goes off when people, we talk about stuff like that. So it's an honor. And then, Ray, it's an honor talking to you. And to know, as you probably know this, that Gwen Dickey is from Florida.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I met her right at Betty Wright's studio when I first met her. We were there because Betty and I have been friends for years, and Gwen, of course, was here and trying to get a start, and she got one. She really got one.
Joe Pep from Undisputed Truth is the one who found Gwen in Florida and brought her
with
her. Yeah, it was Joe Pep. Joe Pep trained her with Norman when she was, what, 17, something like that? I don't know, very young, very green to the industry. And the story is that Norman said he was going to make her a star. She was his Diana Ross, like, what's her name? Supreme with Barry. And the only difference was he wasn't trying to date Gwen.
Yeah. You need to send a copy of this interview to her. It would do her a world of good.
Well, I'm pretty sure that I talked to Joe this morning, and we're trying some things, because Joe wants me to bring Gwen in when we start working on some of the older songs for the soundtrack for what I'm doing with the whole documentary. And Joe definitely wants to bring Gwen back home to work and be a part of whatever we're going to do. Because I'm bringing all of the Whitfield, I'm going to be uplifting and doing the Whitfield Records material, which is on May 12th publishing, which is Norman, because that's the catalog that kind of suffered after he left Warner Brothers, except Car Wash and all that stuff was not on Warner Brothers with those records. It was on MCA, so that's why that stuff still lives large. Of course, Wishing on a Star lives large, and Love Don't Live Anymore lives large, but those albums don't get very much play or any publishing things on it because of his situation at Warner Brothers, and he was 50% owner of all of his stuff. And at Warner Brothers, it was a little different. And just to connect the dots, that's one of the reasons why he pulled me to the side when the lawsuit happened, because it was on Warner Brothers' team. He said, look, you don't need to be fooling with them people, because they'll put you under. You know, so be careful. He said, you know, these are big, big machine people. And you need to not, you're too young and you don't have a career long enough to be able to withstand it like me. He said, they still got to pay me, Benny. I had 150 hit records. I made people a lot of money. You ain't made nobody no money. Now you trying to sue these people. Hey, I had to take that for what it was. I had to listen to it.
Yes.
You know. So anyway, I'm not going to go back into that. I thought it was a good way to connect the story of what we're talking about with Gwen, because he loved Gwen. He really did. And treated her like his daughter. Okay.
Well, you know what? Speaking of her, I'm going to play the song that she did, the one that y'all just mentioned. I'm going down. It's 3 minutes, y'all. Okay?
Okay.
So can y'all allot me that? Okay.
Time on my hands since you've been away, boy. Against my window pane is slowly driving me insane, boy.
Well, that's still just such a beautiful song. It still just touches you.
Yes, it did.
You can't duplicate that. I said you can't duplicate that, my friend.
No,
right.
You can't.
Right.
Now, you said Norman Whitfield, Mr. Winfield, he wrote that song. Was it personal?
Yes. Hmm?
You care to elaborate?
Well, I can tell you this. When he got called to do the soundtrack for Car Wash, Norman Whitfield actually set on in the all the songs was written from every scene from the movie from Norman Whitfield being in on the dailies when they used to have the dailies, and he would write the stuff, and he wrote every song to a particular scene for the movie. And I'm Going Down was one of them when the lady was in the room with the prostitute. I think that was the scene with the prostitute that was in the always go in the bathroom to change her clothes and stuff in the movie. And that's what was, I'm Going Down, you know, type of thing. She was feeling bad or whatever. So that's where the song comes from. And he, like I said, he wrote everything in that movie for that movie, about that movie. So the scenes was actually written into the movie. This lyrics.
Yeah, there's one that I have to ask you about because, you know, according to what's going on in the world today, war. Now, there was no war going on during
I'm
that time.
I'm glad you mentioned war. Huh?
Pardon me?
I am so glad you mentioned that, but go ahead.
Now, I mean, I'm just curious. What do you know what motivated him to write War?
All the ball of confusion was first. They both was in 1970.
Yes, War was by Edwin Starr, and I thought that was done over the Golden Wheel.
No, I tell you what happened. It was done. It was done by the Temptations first.
War?
Yes. And
really, I never heard that.
Yeah, it's a version out there. You can look it up right now. You'll find it. Barry Gordy didn't want to release War.
He didn't deal with nothing political.
Exactly.
I can see that, but I sure did not know that. So I'm learning something tonight myself. I had no idea. Now go ahead with your story.
Yeah, well, Ball of Confusion was the setup, and then War, and then all of this was the setup for Marvin with What's Going On. That's when it really changed. First, Norman was taking chances, and Barry was like, nope, we ain't doing that. We can't put War out on Temptation. That's political. So we're going to go get the guy from Golden World, Rick TikTok Records, Edwin Starr, to let him do it, who had some regional hits already, 25 Miles to Go and all that stuff. And so Norman gave it on Edwin and made it a hit.
Let me ask you this, man. Excuse me?
I'm sorry. I just looked it up, and War is on the Psychedelic Shack album of the Temptations.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that. But didn't that come out on Golden World, though?
Not on Golden World. It came out on Motown.
Whatever Stars War was on Motown?
On Motown, yeah. That's when... Because you just said they say.
When you bought the...
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just said it when you bought it.
See, I thought he was still at Golden World.
But the contract came from Golden World when he bought
Golden World.
You know, Norman used to have, I mean, not Norman, but there used to be a label with the guy?
Wingate.
Eric Wingate.
Is Golden World Wingate?
Yeah. And then Don Davis was running. They was doing Thelma Records.
Mm-hmm. And Don was over at Golden World too, right?
Which is named after Barry Gordy's first wife,
right. Mm-hmm.
Thelma.
Oh, okay.
And then those got bought, but Barry bought all that.
You remember, Antoinette, I was talking about how Golden World had started making a little noise and Barry Gordy bought them out?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what he's talking about, Golden World. And this is the time that when he bought Golden World,
When he brought Edwin over there, then I guess he put, that's when he put war on them.
Exactly.
That's the Temptations that I already had.
Yeah. And he didn't want to do it on the Temptations as a single. He just put it on the album.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a hit on now let me tell you about a story in 2000. When did 9-1-1 happen? 2001? I'm in the studio with Norman Whitfield, Paramount Studios in L.A. Norman recut War, himself singing. And we were mixing the song, and that morning we was watching the screen and the planes hit the towers while we was in there doing War.
While we were mixing it.
And we was all tired, and them planes went off the hook, and Norman said, "Why me?" He said, "God, do it again." He said, "This song is so relevant again, we getting ready to go to war."
Oh, my.
Wow. And then comes the next day. Called me up, "Vinny, get in the studio. Come get me right now. We got to go to the studio. I just came up with a song, another song, and I got it. And that's the one I'm working on. I'm finishing. Called Lawless Society." One of those songs. Yes, a new song that he wrote in the vein of what's going on today and what was going on then is still going on now, and he left me with it, and we got it, and I'm going to be doing a version of it and putting it together for this project called Lawless Society, one of Norman's favorite songs that he sung, and he sounded like Curtis Mayfield, his favorite producer.
Oh, wow. Now
hurry up and get that one out, my brother.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I wish I could play it right now, but I can't. Unreleased. Nobody ever heard them but us. People always think I'm crazy. Oh, man, that's old. Nobody want to hear that. I said, "You listen to what he's saying?" And I get passionate about it. I be looking at him, "Why are you so mad?" I said, "Because y'all ain't listening. Y'all calling it old. This man is talking about, he wrote like this all the time." And that sparked him that night, and the 9-1-1 sparked him to write that song. He wrote it in a day. Benny, get on this. Benny, play the bongos right there, Benny. You know, she was something else, but a genius. Definitely a genius in my eyes. And when I say genius, you know, people get that twisted sometimes.
This week's boy, Chef.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was a lot of great talent that came out of Detroit, you know, that when it comes to writing these songs and the singers that they have performing them, you know, it's a lot of great talent that came from Detroit that, you know, when we had the Tuskegee Airmen on, they talked about when they were overseas how, you know, Motown, Miss Kim's song, you know, in Motown is what helped them get through. And, you know, I mean, now I see that, you know, that Norman's songs was another factor, I'm sure, in helping people get through whatever they were going through.
Not the Tuskegee Airmen, baby, because I was 4 years old. I said not the Tuskegee Airmen, because the Tuskegee Airmen, that was in the 40s. That was before Motown. But a lot of our soldiers say that Motown really helped them while they were you know, on guard duty or whatever, you know. But I've had people tell me that they were, I've had many soldiers walk up to me and tell me that they were on guard duty when they heard Lift Every Voice and what that did for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, and did a lot. I mean, that's our national anthem, right? That's the black folks' national anthem.
Exactly.
But I mean, not only that, but like you said, Motown, that's what helped them to get through, because that sound was, that was the sound from home, you know, that helped them while they were away from home and in a horrific situation, you know, to hear that sound, you know, that was the closest that they could get to home at that time.
Yeah.
I want to say this. We're talking about a great guy named Norman. We're talking about, I'm sitting here running my mouth. But we're sitting in front of a legend right here.
So God be the glory.
And
yes,
we're sitting in front of someone that has so much history and what she went through and what she was doing that she's talking about everybody else. But I got to go back to her first song that Norman wrote with her. It should have been me. That means it should have been her.
Yeah. Norman used to have a saying, he'd ask the ladies, how would you like to be queen for a day? Every time he queen, nobody told you about queen for the day. You know, and he keep walking.
Wow. But so it's a pleasure for you to have me on your show. It's a pleasure to talk to Ray. I want to say Foster Royal. Because I didn't know
sir.
He was the brother of Walter till Miss Kim just told me. So it's a pleasure to have you on the phone talking to me as well, on the air where people can hear us.
Antoinette.
Yes,
Antoinette.
Ma'am.
Antoinette. Do you think
yes.
you could pull up? You think you could play First Man for Benny before the show is over?
What's it called again, Miss Kim?
First Man, I'm talking about Ray's song. I want
oh,
him to
yes,
hear Ray.
Yes. Oh,
I was telling him that Ray, tell him about you and Marvin.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say I'm just so grateful that I had the opportunity to talk to you, Vince. I didn't know you. I knew your name, but I didn't know you, and I didn't know the history that you shared with us tonight. So I am really grateful for that because I think it's all part of where we are going as a people. We must know our history. We must teach these young people the truth about ourselves, about themselves. And music, in my opinion, is the way. I grew up in Washington. And I sang with Marvin Gaye and Van McCoy, Bonnie Hathaway, and I sang in the choir together at New Bethel Baptist Church. So I've got a musical history myself. I still write songs and music, but I'm not in the industry yet. You know, so to speak. But I realized that until that generation that you're representing wakes up and gives this music back to our people to wake them up to who we are and the power that we have that God has given us. You know, when I first met Kim Weston, I think she was 18 or 19 years old. We had a convention in Washington with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and she was singing, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Well, that was the first time I'd heard the song.
Mm-hmm.
I'd heard anybody sing the song. But I knew that Mahalia Jackson recorded the song, and she was the first person to record it. Well, Kim was the second person to record it. And when I started thinking about it, this is the way to wake the people. They have to hear this. You have to lift every voice and sing. And as far as I'm concerned today, the Kim Weston is the matriarch of the movement, today's movement to wake the people. And I'm thankful that she's around and that she's still, you know, able to do
it. I didn't know Mahalia Jackson did it.
Yes, yes. And we're reviving it. As a matter of fact, I have a drum track for it that I put together because I felt that that the drum, our ancestors used the drum to communicate with one another, and they used the drum to communicate with God. And the Spirit of God woke me up one morning and told me that, and I decided to organize it and put it together. And I asked him if she would serve on the board of directors, and she greatly, graciously did and is. And we're trying to, you know, wake the people. Because it's our time now to wake up. You know, we've got a lot of work to do, and we need to put the right people together to do it. And God is doing it. Everything that's happening, he's pre-orchestrating this move for you, brother. I appreciate you and all of those who've worked with you. Yeah.
You too, man. It's been my pleasure.
I'm going to play First Man now. This is by Brother Ray. And this is his song. This is beautiful.
You're the mother of the first, first woman, brother. And the pyramids, they've been here 12,000 years. You charted the heavens with your eyes, flew your spaceships through the sky. You crossed the Alps on an elephant's back to save your land. Let's talk about that, brother. You're the father of the earth. Come on, we go now. You're the father.
That was our brother Ray.
Yes, I wrote that song in 1995, and it was a result of a conversation in 1995. It's a result of a conversation I had with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I did a lot of work with him. I used to take him around in D.C. when he would come, and I went through a lot of the voter registration drives throughout the South back in the day. And one time, one church we left, it'd been the first time I'd been to a church where the people came just as they were. They came with no shoes. They came with coveralls, out the fields and all of that. And I began to realize that we really don't know who we are. We're God's people. We're the first man. We're the first woman. We're the ones created in the image. So that's why I wrote that, and I have other songs like that I wrote. And that's why I appreciate Marvin so much, because we were, we were very close back in high school and all, and in D.C. And, those things just kind of stick with both of us. I just recognized his spirituality then, the history of what we're trying to recreate. And I just welcome anybody who understands what that is. That's why we created the drum call. And the drum call wakes people up. Things are changing because they're hearing it. And it's not something that we're putting in the news or on the newspaper. It's a word-of-mouth project that's gone around the world now. People are drumming all over the world. They're so frustrated at the times that we're living in, what's going on, and they're looking for answers. And the drum call relieves that stress and kind of brings us together. So that's what that's all about.
That's every Sunday at 3 o'clock.
Okay. That song is very powerful.
Help.
Yes, it is.
It has a great feel. A great feel. You know, good feeling songs capture people. The lyrics is outstanding. And people got to get back to being able to have those melodies like you have to go along with good lyrics, opposed to just saying anything just to get the melody going because you're listening to the beat.
Yes.
You got the whole thing.
And that's all but historical facts.
You know?
Those are all historical.
I admire the fact that you shared that with me. Now, was that song released before, or is it just now? You said you wrote it in 95.
I wrote it. It's never been released. I only released it myself. I had my own label when I released it. But no, it's there. I mean, we can do things with it. I mean, it's no problem.
No. Well, what's the name of the label?
The label I had is Cassie Vine Records. That was my grandmother's name. But it's never been published. My song is copywritten, of course. But it's never been into the public. So, I'm free and open to whatever is, you know, will make it go, will make the people wake the people.
Gotcha.
God's doing
yes, and
it.
Also
God's
the
doing
song
it.
My Hero. Your Hero song, too, that you wrote, you know, in recognition of your brothers?
Yeah. You know, Vince, these songs I did myself, and I did them in studios where I could get in. No big time, nothing. So
wow.
People like you could help, you know, could make it do what it's supposed to do.
Right. Hey, how long have you been in Florida?
Buddy, I came to Florida in 1978.
Okay.
I came
so
here for...
So you know about Malico Records, right?
Of course. That means you know about Margaret Reynolds.
Who?
Margaret Reynolds.
No, I don't.
Okay.
Sorry to say.
Well, there's some... She had some big hits back in the day that never got out either. But she was a friend of... That's how I met Betty Wright. Well, that's how Betty Wright introduced me to Margaret Reynolds, who was with Malico at that time. So that's what I know about it. That's all I know about it, Malico.
Have you ever Malico Records back in 78 had a young singer out of Bay City, Michigan, Saginaw era, named James Bradley. It was on Malico, and the song was Can't Get Enough of Your Love, I'm In Too Deep. That was one of the guys I grew up listening to in Bay City. He was one of the first guys. You know, there's another group besides Madonna being from Bay City. It was Question Mark and the Mysterians is from Bay City, who had the number one hit in 66, 96 Tears.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad was friends with Frank Rodriguez and all those guys. I still talk to the guitar player, Robert Baltimore, now. He's still there and still doing his thing from Question Mark and Mysterio. That song was basically the first garage band type song to hit the market, and it was done in Bay City, Michigan, in the garage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So... And,
that's when we had real bands.
I say that to say James Bradley came up after that. And all this is from before Madonna even hit. James Bradley came after that and went away, and he had that record on Malico Records. He had an album on there. And I just thought maybe, like, that's why I asked him. You said 78. I was like, oh, he might know who I'm talking about. You know. Yeah.
I moved to Miami just out of frustration and, you know, because I worked so hard up there with the movement and I did work with Al Bell and ICA Records and Monk Higgins and all those guys. And it was just it was rough for us back, and it really started to come after. So slow our road down because we were beginning to take over the music industry. You know, everything we put out were hits. I mean, our people, when I say that.
Right.
So they slowed it down. And of course, I don't know if you know about the Al Bell story or the ICA record story. Maybe
Al
we'll
Bell?
Talk about that. Yes.
You said, "Oh yeah, Al Bell's my man too." That's another
yeah,
yeah. Reverend Norman Whitfield guy introduced me to him, and he gave me I had a distribution deal through my company, through my partner and I's company called Black Orchid Records with Belmont Records when he had that. When he had Whoop, There It Is out, and Norman was doing work for Al then. With a group called, they were like a Temptations group back in 96. I forget the name of the group now. But anyway, they had a song called Stop the Rain. Never did get released. And Norman actually was writing that song for Yvonne Fair. But Yvonne Fair passed away. And he said it really wasn't for Yvonne Fair, really it was for Tina Turner.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it never got to Tina Turner. The Next Movement was the name of the group out of Las Vegas. They sounded just like the Temptations. So Norman recut the song. Spider Turner did the demo for it. And, you know, he did a great job. Boy, they could have released it on him. Actually, it was probably better with him on it. Because Spider is something else. You know, and... but they put it on, but it was actually for Tina Turner. Yvonne Fair and Tina Turner. I was telling Tim about it the other day. And that was just a sidebar to say what we were talking about, the different people and me coming up with the James Bradley, all that kind of stuff. So I kind of went to the left on y'all a little bit because I wanted to say that.
You're good. We have another caller, and then I want to ask you about some of the rap stars. So I'm going to bring this caller in. Okay, why won't it go? Okay, there it is. Brother Kwame, hello.
Good evening, Sister Antoinette. Good evening, Brother Ray. Good evening, my lovely Miss Kim Weston.
I love you.
I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Nothing you can do about it either.
And to your guest there, greetings to him also. You know, I came in a little late.
Vincent.
Ray's song was...
His name is Vincent.
Okay, Vincent. I apologize. I hadn't known. But what I'm hearing and Ray with the drum call and following along with him, Kim Weston, you know, these are two elders that we have to understand that they have a story, and they always say the message is in the music. But the also part of it is that the message is in the drum, because the drum is the first thing that we hear in the womb, and we live our lives from that beat, because every person has a heartbeat. And what Ray has been given with saying forget the drum to give the communication for the spiritual battling that we have to do now is very important that we understand too, that, and I think Vincent was saying the part of the rhythm and all the melodies of it, but to take that song and put it with drums in today's genre would be something unique and different, because the thing that we have is we have electronic machines, but when we go back to the djembe and the kungas and the drums that were the original drums that we use would be a way in which to put that heart message, because, you know, here on this earth, and that word earth also has the word heart, it also has the word here, and it has also the word ear. And getting one to listen with the ear of the heart is connecting to the soul. And that's why I see what Ray is doing with having this drum call is very important, because we've got to reconnect our spirits back to Mother Earth. And being that we are the Creator's creation here on Earth, and being able to do that heartbeat of the Earth. The Earth has its own heartbeat. And what we're doing is reconnecting ourselves back to it, because we were herded into urban areas and we were banned from Mother Earth. Over us is the universe and also our Milky Way galaxy. But the universe, as Dr. King said, it bends towards justice. And we're looking at how do we get justice for our people and all that we have done, because we are the first people. And we have to begin to understand that white body supremacy and this new species that believe it to be the greater, which in all reality they are the lesser, because there are more people of color than they are of absence of color. And so we have a spiritual battle that we are fighting right now in this now moment. But the thing is that we have to trust that the Creator of all that is giving us a guiding way to listen to our heart, listen to your heartbeat. And so that's why I support Ray, and Ms. Kim Weston is bringing up the Tuskegee Airmen. And the message that we have to understand is we gave this Turtle Island, what they call America, we gave them their first classical music called jazz, but we did it more so in the fields. We were singing those spirituals and those work songs because we were connected to the earth, and the energy coming up through those bare feet in the cotton fields was singing about what was going on in that person's heart as they would bend over from sun up to sundown picking that cotton. So we got to honor those ancestors by creating that sound of the heartbeat for us.
I agree with that. Yep. I don't know when you came in, but that's what Brother Benny's doing and bringing Norman Whitfield to the forefront, and that's telling our story. Norman was my very first producer, and I was the very first production that he had. And for him to go on and create the things that he did, and it was from his heart. And because he believed in what he believed in, and he moved from his heart, he was blackballed as well. Very seldom tells a story about, and Brother Benny talking about him being at Watch Stacks, you know, the heart of the people was there. You could feel it. And we were all on one beat. We were all on one rhythm. But in the meantime, because the people stood there with their fist in the air, I mean, to see something like that, 100,000 people, one time in agreement, on one accord, it also created a problem. And I was blackballed, but I'm still standing here.
That's an excellent point, Ms. Kim. And see, the thing about it is there's unity when the music is correct, because if you watch somebody, a group of people doing the electric slide, they look like a school of fish in a natural rhythm. Every person does not miss a beat. They got their own little dips and whatever, but everybody stays in sync. If we could sync our minds together and being able to construct and not destruct our communities, we can be the most powerful people we were once were when we built civilization.
Absolutely. And that's what we're doing tonight, because I'm learning myself.
Right.
I am
too. And Vincent said it. You know, he was saying that the group that was started, Garage Music, you know, that's something unique to where we didn't have to go into a studio and pay studio time and have a big old mixing board to do all of that. We synchronized our spirit. And everybody coordinated together in one beat. And this is what you see in a drum circle. One person will start off beating, and everybody synchronizes with that person, the lead bass drum.
Yeah.
The bass has always been the lead and the drum.
Yeah. Vincent, do you want to tell us the story about, you said when Norman heard it being played, but it wasn't being played right, they were using the computer.
Trying to think of what song you, what I'm trying to figure out. I didn't told you so much about
I know. You had told me last night it was you were doing a song and he told y'all don't do it that way and y'all were trying to, you know, get it by him. And when he heard it, he busted y'all.
You're talking about the last song that he ever produced in the studio.
Yes.
But it wasn't for commercial use. It was for him. And he wrote, his first song he ever wrote in his life, he was 12. And he wrote it in a poem about his parents. At the time, he was doing My Little Boy. That was one of his gifts to us because he knew that he was passing away. And he had started working on some material for my boy. And he wanted, it was a part of his book and his story and what he was trying to do. He didn't want to ruin my son in the industry because he was young. He said, I'm not going to do that. And he wrote these songs. He wrote one other song called Hollywood that was amazing about telling the story about if you want to be a star in Hollywood. Have my son sing it. But this particular song, he said, I don't want you guys do not, this got to go into the Motown Museum. You got to get it over there to that new museum, Vinny. It was called Know Me Without You. And he wrote it when he was 12. And he told me his pops told him, writing songs and all that stuff was for sissies. They don't make no money. Of course, we know Norman made a lot of money writing songs. And he ended up taking care of his parents. You know, with his money. And he loved his family, all of them. He loved his family so much, it was ridiculous. Just like everybody does, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had a special place because of his upbringing. Well, he wanted to use my son in his last recording sessions. He said, told me and my wife, I need you guys to let me borrow your son for a couple of days. Now, you can be there if you want to, but you might not like me after I get done because I'm going to wear his little ass out. That's what he said. He said, that little boy, I love that little boy, and I want him to do something special for me. I'm going to do this. I'm going to write my poem. I'm going to do my poem. I'm going to do my song. I'm going to sing it myself, and I'm going to teach him the song. And I want him to sing that song like he's singing it to you and your wife, because you guys are some of the best parents I ever seen. I wish I would have took care of my sons like you do yours. That's what he told me. And then when he did the song on my son, this is when he got sick. And then we broke for a minute, and he went into the hospital. And he came home then, but he never came back to the studio. He only went to his house. He stayed the rest of his time before he went back in the hospital in his bed. So he wanted to finish that song so bad that he had my son and I come over there, and he was doing the song with him while he was in his bed, while we was watching the games, you know, the basketball games and stuff.
Yeah.
And he had my son doing the song. And then the producer that he was working with that did the tracks for him and all those things, he had to record my son the last time because Norman wanted to recut the vocals. And the first thing he told him was, don't think you're going to get by putting that auto-tune shit on the song. I don't want that stuff. I want the real deal. If he got to sing it over 100,000 times, I don't care. Make that little nigga work. He's young enough. He was in that studio and at his house arguing with my little boy at 12 years old like he was arguing with Marvin Gaye and all of them. I was like, man, you so, man, you better leave my son alone. Hey, man, I told you you don't want to be involved. Get your ass out of here because I got this. And my son would just laugh at him. And he loved me. He just laugh at him. He said, Mr. McPhill, you're just so funny. You ain't going to do nothing. That kind of thing. Norman would reach in his pocket and say, give that nigga $100 because, you know, he's something special, man. He said he can sing his butt off. He ain't no Michael Jackson. Ain't nobody like Michael Jackson, but he close. He good. He good. I can work with it. He said, but don't bring me no song with no auto-tune on it. I don't want to hear it. And you thought Norman didn't know. Norman had impeccable ears. That's the other thing. His ears were so impeccable. Norman could be asleep, and you could be recording the song, and you think he didn't hear them bad notes. And then when you got done, he wake up and go, and you know damn well you got to do that over because that shit was so off, I don't know what that. We used to just look up and say, he was just knocked out sleep. Well, he did that with this auto-tune thing. We went in the studio, and he wasn't in there with us when we did the mix. And Dave was like, yeah, I'm going to put a little auto-tune on because Chris is kind of flat there, and we don't really have him, blah, 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 whatever, right? We went to the house, yeah. And he played that stuff. Norman said, Norman cussed David out and me out so bad. He said, didn't I tell y'all not to put that shit on my record? I want it just like I did it. He made us go back and take it all off. And he knew. And I couldn't even tell it was an auto-tune because David was good at that. Because the auto-tune is not for to do it the way the people was using it. Now they made it the Roger Troutman song. Roger Troutman did his thing with a talk box, in which was he singing notes. Well, the auto-tune people, now they just make it sound like a computer or whatever, and they got all this nice stuff. Well, you could use the auto-tune because it was a new technique in the studio that if your vocals came out pitchy or not right, you just turn a little knob and make it right to adjust it. You couldn't tell auto-tune was on it. I don't know how Norman knew, but he knew. And that's what you're telling me to talk about. That's the piece.
Yes.
And am I correct?
Yes, you're correct.
Okay, so that was that story. So that was a special song, and nobody has ever heard it but me and my wife and the producers and the people. And it's a treat. Okay?
Well, now, when are you gonna release this so that we can hear these things and your book and tell us when your book and everything so that we're able to listen to this and read this?
Well, my book is the first piece that I'm working on. And I'm working with a gentleman that Norman brought to me in L.A., and he works
mm-hmm.
for BMG right now. Yeah. And BMG Rights Management. So we're working on the project to get the deal complete. And then once we get that deal in place, we're doing a stage theater play with a young lady by the name of Sheila Finn out of Detroit, who's doing a little play or constantly doing a story about Dream Boy Norman and me, which is me and my relationship with Dream Boy and Norman and my travels in the industry. And through that compilation of songs that I'm going to put together, I'm going to release and put some of the music that my son did on that soundtrack. And I couldn't tell you exactly when I'm going to release it, but it'll definitely be, I would say, 2023.
Okay. Yep, so we'll have to watch for that. You have to come back, of course. Now, what about your book?
Well, my book is being done. It's just about done. Now I'm doing the finishing touches with it now so that it could be rewritten. The ghostwriters, the people that's going to put it in form, that should be out no later than – I'm trying to do that probably the first of the year and maybe even earlier than that. It depends on kind of like the platform or strategy that we're gonna go about releasing it, because that's one of the reasons why we're going to do a play. And now I'm going to be working with Adina Holland as well. Sheila Finn is doing the play, and Adina Holland is going to be doing some media and film stuff to help generate interest about the book, about what we're doing. Hopefully a film will be done. She's going to be doing a lot of different things. But basically, the concept came from Norman all along when we were doing his book and his last recordings, and that was what the concept. He said, "Ben, you need a platform. Everybody want to hear about me, but they don't want to hear about you because you ain't done nothing. So you got to create a platform for it." So that's what this is about, having other avenues to promote the book, because the book is just real book. Stephen King, I mean, one of them kind of guys, I mean, you know, hey, what is the book going to do? Who wants to read a story about some people, you know, that they don't know? You know, I get that all the time. Benny, who wants to listen to your dream? Well, they're right in a sense, but my purpose is to get that dream out and get people listening to the other people that's the underdogs or the people that don't have the opportunity to share their stories with people. I feel that I have a big story that connects to people's lives and careers, but I'm coming from the character of people opposed to how much money they made. I ain't talking about how much money the man made. I ain't talking about how many kids he got. That's irrelevant because everybody know how much he's worth. They don't know about the man. So I'm telling them about my relationship with that man and my travels with my group Dream Boy and how they were signed to. I wasn't an original member of Dream Boy. I was a second or sixth member that came along by the way of one of my friends who helped me join, and I became a road guy, road crew manager, and setting up equipment and all those different things with them, and that's when my dream picked back up, and I was able to start in Detroit, that was, and that's when the Detroit life came in on my side of my life. So that's basically what the stories are going to be, it's going to be about, and I'm going to use these different avenues to create a platform for the book to get attention. And that's basically, and then, I got to mention this. My friend who used to work for Norman Whitfield, Bobby Holland, he's the guy that's going to be doing the official documentary on Norman Whitfield himself from the side of the method to his madness, who this hitmaker was. From the Motown to his own Whitfield, only two labels he ever worked for was Whitfield Records and Motown Records. But he's known all over the globe. So Bobby's going to come in and put the professional, top-of-the-line documentary film on Norman Whitfield himself. Mine's just talking about the character. Of course, you're going to hear the songs. I'm going to be coming more from the Whitfield Records side. And the side that he left me when he was recording stuff that was unreleased. So that's the synopsis of what I'm going to be doing. And I started late doing it because you know there's bumps and bruises in the road. And then I got with Sheila Finn, and then finally me and Dina and Sheila Finn, boom! I created a team that could help me put this. Oh, I can't forget my friend that worked with me with Norman directly, Allison Rose Jefferson out of Los Angeles. She was the person that was writing books and everything. And she's one that told me I need to write that book. That's how it all came about. So that's my story. I don't want to give any more. That was it. I gave a lot. I wanted to give a lot, and I can't wait to do part two. Because in part two, let me say this to you.
Now, if you could say any words that he will be able to hear now to sum it up, what would you say to him?
I would say, thank you, Norman. You knew what you were talking about. You told me everybody was going to tell me I was crazy. You told me that no one was going to want to listen to this. But I told you, long as you got a platform and you got a reason to do this, with your story, you're going to flourish. It's going to happen because people want to hear about me. But I ain't never spoke up. I never wanted to tell my story. I don't like glory. That's what he told me. He said, so you need to carry my legacy for me. And I did it, your son, for that purpose, because your son is 12 years old, and he did Just My Imagination incredibly well, which you definitely going to hear that. I will play that for you in part two, because I don't have it right now. I would end this thing with that song right now if I had got it to you a little earlier, but it takes me a little time to get it, to get that version, because we don't let those things out. But that song has been done before, so it wouldn't have hurt to use that song as a piece to leave you guys with, that he did, one of his last productions that he did before he passed. But I would tell him, Norman, I got it. He told me I was going to feel it when this stuff started hitting. And I've been feeling the spirit. I've been feeling that the stars are lining up. When you know it's right, you're going to feel it. And that's what he told me, and I feel it right now. I feel all of this that is coming together. And he's up there saying, go, Vinny. Tell the story, Vinny. So I got to tell him, thank for him for putting up with me over the years.
Yes.
As I put up with him.
Yes, and we're grateful that
he cussed me out 100,000 times. Bucked me back. And brought me back the next day. Want your job back, be here at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Now,
then I sit there
Kim,
all day long doing nothing.
Now, Miss
anyway,
Kim, she made an impact on your life. And you want to tell us how Miss Kim's impact on your life has been.
Miss Kim, we didn't even know how much we didn't even know Miss Kim at that time. We were 10. What the impact was we knew who that lady was singing that national anthem with Jesse Jackson standing up there. We hold our hand up in the sky. I didn't learn to later on in life who Kim Gibson Weston really was. Now, you know when I got to know who she was when it started, my mom and them, rock me, little while, all that stuff. Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, then I knew him. You know, when it started, and then It Takes Two, come on, ooh. We ain't gonna know that now. But when watching her, it was about lift every voice and sing on that platform in front of, in that Coliseum, in front of the, in that big old Coliseum. And that stuck with me forever.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy to be here talking to this woman, this lady. And I gotta tell y'all this, she's like, I hope she don't slap me in the room. But when I hear her talk, she reminds me, my grandmother tell us, because my grandmother was my rock that made me play drums. She said, you going to play them drums, boy? I hear Kim's voice, and I go, that's my grandmother's voice.
I feel the same way. Yeah.
No, it's for real. It is. Anybody,
it is.
I called home before this interview and called my family and told them to listen to your program, right, and what we're doing. And I told my cousin, my oldest cousin on my mom's side, she's an inspiration. She was a singer, too. And she herself at 16, she auditioned for Motown with her group through Jimmy Brooks. Brought her up to Detroit and auditioned for Motown as a girl group. And they told her, come back when you've grown, when y'all 18, because we got all these girl group singers in there. Where y'all going to fit in at?
Oh,
and her
wow.
name is Denise. Her name is Denise Gibson Tyeska. And her group is called Les Elegantes with Deborah Davis and Harriet. Well, forget Harriet's last name. I forget it. But Harriet, But Harriet is one of my favorites. She and my cousin kind of end up playing with me later on when I was 16, singing background with one of the groups I was playing with, which was a cherished moment. But I told my cousin Denny, when you listen to the program and you hear Kim talk, I want you to tell me who she's reminding you of when you hear her talking. And I guarantee she's going to say, Miss Ernestine all the way. You know? And it warms my heart, because that's the woman that had my back and my mama's back okay?
Yes.
That baby.
Yes. Okay. Yes, because Miss Kim Webb, she will take you under her wing.
Yes.
She will take you under her wing. Now, you said, you talked about the show that he ended with, and our closing, I'm going to start with the song that he began with Miss Kim. If anybody has any questions or comments, I'm sorry, Miss Kim, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, you don't have to play that one again. But look at here, before we go, I want the family to say hello to the son and daughter of Eddie Holland, who incidentally was the first Motown person that I met. And Eddie's son, what's his name again? Oh, you do know him. Okay. He was asking me about a young man, and it was the young man that, you know, I'd be telling you all the time, Antoinette, about how I did a concert for the church. Well, I produced the concert for the church. And when the concert was over, the guy said that I remind him of a female James Cleveland. The guy took me to the demo session. He asked me about doing a demo, which I didn't even know what a demo was. But when he told me I could get paid, I told him, okay. But he took me to this demo session, and the writer, the guy's name was Johnny Thornton. Well, Johnny Thornton is a cousin of Eddie and Brian Holland, right? And Eddie was at the demo session, and Eddie's the one that went back and told the people at Motown that he heard this girl singing. Well, Johnny was writing the music for Motown. He submitted the music. They didn't like his music, but they liked the girl singer. So that's how I started. And Edward and his sister, Adina, they're not twins. They're here. They're bringing over here, and I just want them to say hello, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hi.
Hello.
This is my first time even knowing of your show, but I hope that I can be a part of it one day and continue to listening to it, because you have a very informative guest.
Anytime, we would love to have you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay, Antoinette, this is Adina. We spoke earlier today. Yes, remember earlier with Vinny, we did a three-way call?
Yes, I do. How are you?
I'm doing well, yes. It was a great show. I enjoyed, you know, being here amongst everyone, and it was great.
Well, this is part one, so they'll be back for part two, okay? And then they'll be able to say a little more, because Edward probably remembers Norman, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember him, darling?
No, I don't.
I didn't think you would, Edward would be able to speak on Norman and what
I remember. You should have known because he cut me out when I met Adina at the office. When he said, "Don't you say nothing to that girl, that's family."
Thank you so much, Antoinette,
if anybody has a question, if you can make your question like a minute or two, we can go until the half an hour mark, if you don't mind, and then we'll call it a night. And Friday, I will be back with Brother Ray, and we're going to be talking about nation building and, you know, things like that. And we do have a question, so don't forget us on Friday. But tomorrow's Friday. Okay, so don't forget us tomorrow. And we're going to work on Brother Eddie and I being back on Saturday. And don't forget Dry Bones on Sunday at 10 a.m. for the Helios Filios. And for now, okay, Brother West.
Hey, how y'all be? Good show, Antoinette. Good show. It was right on time. But I just want to tell y'all something. It's an interview with Barry White, said in 1983, about the computer was going to take over everything, the music and everything. So y'all check that out. And then I'm going to take y'all all the way back to the beginning. All right? All the way back to the beginning.
Okay.
That old Lucifer, the one, he was the choir director in heaven. Y'all know that, right? Lucifer, that pretty angel
yes.
of light. He
yep,
was the choir director
yep,
in heaven.
He was in charge of
and
music.
So,
yes.
There you go. So now they flipped the music in 1978, y'all. That's
yeah.
when they dropped the frequency, the low-frequency music. Okay, that's why everything went haywire. And I tell you all the song that went that did it was a song by Houdini called Wicked, Wicked, Wicked. All right, you listen to that song,
okay.
you'll feel all mad, angry. All right, oh, but anyway, I'm going to leave it like that to Antoinette until we give y'all the abbreviated version. But right on, man. Right on. Right on. I know you, Miss Kim. I know you can take care of now. But it's all good. I love y'all. I'm going to mute myself.
Okay, well,
you, darling. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, I guess nobody else has anything that they want to say. So, in closing, I'm going to play
but,
the song that he started. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Brother Kwame.
Yeah, but to Brother Vincent, and I thank him for sharing that story on Norman. And there was two key parts that he was talking about, and the part that Norman could hear any imperfections in music even when he was asleep because he heard with his heart. And that was our sharing about the earth and the ear and the heart. And to hear with the heart, and that's what he was able to transpose to you and being able to do that because you having that dream, and in that word dream is the word ear, and being able to hear him tell you that you have all of these possibilities is what you're doing now, and I commend you for it.
Well, thank you so much. And I thank Miss Antoinette Pondexter for having me as her guest. I thank God for all of this, number one. And I have to thank Adina and Eddie for coming with me because I don't drive anymore. And then Adina is my managing partner. She's managing me through this all this stuff, and she's my partner along with Sheila Finn. And they've been doing a great job helping me pull this thing together. And Jeff Stanton, my best friend, and the Dream Boys, the whole nine has helped me get through all this stuff myself, and that's how I'm in here with Kim because of my best friend, Jeff, who was working with Kim also. So I am so proud and happy that someone is giving me a floor to tell my story because everybody just tells me I just runs my mouth, you know, and I just like running my mouth when it's positive. Exactly, when I know what I'm talking about. And I my mother's the only one that can tell me to shut up. She's the only one that can tell me, man, you need to just stop running your mouth. You know?
Hey, you're doing what you're supposed to do, man.
I'm thank you, God.
Be quiet.
Okay,
Miss Kim.
Who's that talking there? I who's that just talking? I heard him say something earlier.
Yeah,
something about
Wicked. Yes,
yeah.
Sir. Gina saw, man. That's when they
who
flipped the tone of music, man. So, Houdini. If you listen to it, see, like my man say, you listen with your heart. So I can tell the tone of music.
Did you say
and
Houdini?
So I know how I feel. Yes, sir, Houdini.
Yes,
wicked,
he said
wicked,
Houdini.
Wicked.
Yes.
Do you know Larry
yeah.
Smith?
So, I don't know him, but I know that song is evil, man. It's done in low frequency. But I don't know him personally. I like to tell him, man, he need to flip the tone back to the music, man. Because back in the 60s and 70s, when y'all was writing music,
yeah.
that was all love music, man. Every group in the 70s,
yeah,
50s, 60s,
music.
70s, were all love music. Till 1978, that's when they messed everything up, man. That's when the devil
wow.
took back over the music, man. I see, I'm like Kwame. I could tell by the heart how I feel on sound, and I could tell when the music all jacked up, and people don't realize they're getting mind control. I got the patent for all that, too, but I'll be quiet there. That's another show. But I'll let y'all go ahead and continue, man. I love listening to y'all with them stories, man. You're doing the right thing, man.
Yeah. These are history that we need to know. the history that we don't get. You know, we're not going to get this from mainstream media. They're not going to give it to us.
Hey, Ms. Antoinette.
Yes.
I don't want to change the thought process, but I do would like to request if you would play Rock Me a Little While and take us out, because that's Eddie's song that she did on Miss Kim, and I love, I always love that song, and it's one of my favorites that Kim did.
I'm checking now.
Hey, well, ma'am, you say something about Undisputed Truth. I love that song, Unidentified Objects in the Sky. Oh, my. You remember that?
Oh,
I know who wrote that one.
Yes, I remember that one.
Which one?
Unidentified
UFOs. Norman Whitfield. Yeah. I think Norman Whitfield and Robert Daniels, and he had a crew of writers over there at Whitfield Records. That was some amazing stuff, y'all, that people don't know about.
Yes, sir, man. That's extraterrestrial there, man. That was from the Galactic Federation. That's all right there,
hey,
bro.
You ain't kidding. Yes. Yes. And Joe Pep had a lot to do with that direction with Norman and Wawa Watson. And like the other crew of people that was working with them at Whitfield Records. That was all at Whitfield Records. No, it wasn't. Wait a minute. Unidentified Object in the Sky?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was on Motown. Right before they went to Whitfield Records. I think that was on there. It was. It was on Motown. But Motown, I think, was scared of that kind of stuff that they was doing, that psychedelic and experimental type groups. That Norman's Undisputed Truth was that experimental type. They were going different places and creating another sound other than the same Motown sound.
Mm-hmm. And I saw Wattstack too, man. That was the bomb, brother. I ain't know nobody that concert they had in New York. They had one almost at the same time. But Wattstack was the bomb digging it, man. When Rupert Thomas came out there with the hot pants and the cowboy boots, man. Yeah, hot pants and cowboy boots, man. Rupert Thomas.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Wattstack was the bomb, man. I ain't lying, man.
Yeah, it was. I was there. Hey, that's when I first heard about the Crips and Bloods. People don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
They called the Crips and Bloods out at that show and said they formed a human chain around the whole field.
They brought them out on the field.
That's right.
Wow.
Yes. But Crips
I'm
and Bloods.
I'm sorry, I don't have that.
Crips and Bloods didn't stand. But what they were saying, they do now. It was totally different.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But anyhow, we got another story going. Let me shut up.
Hey, man, bro. That music was the bomb, man. I ain't lying. Back in the 60s and 70s, man. Everybody was good. Even the white groups was good in the 70s, man. Everybody, all the music was good. It wasn't but love, man.
Oh, yeah, in the 60s and 70s, all the music was good, and it was not racial. It was between the artists.
That's right, man.
I mean, everybody was good, man. Everybody. Wasn't that a love time, man? I'm telling you, man.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Take me in your arms. I have that.
Okay,
y'all. Well, we want to thank our guests for being with us. We thank you so much, Vincent, for taking your evening out to be with us. And we look forward to next week when you'll be talking about some more things. And, Ms. Kim, you know, we just love you, and you're always just an inspiration to us all.
Yeah,
and, Brother Ray,
Brother
we thank
Ray
you.
Too.
Yes,
yeah,
Brother
right.
Ray, you too. Well, because, you know, we love you.
And Miss Antoinette.
Yes.
Miss Antoinette. You never
grow
old.
Oh,
Oh, yes, I have that one.
Okay, well, let's play Tiffany and Austin. We do Never Grow Old. We all going to be sitting there crying.
Yeah.
Okay, so which one do y'all want? Now, y'all got to tell me.
Well, you
Take
know, God
the old. That's my favorite.
Which one? I'm sorry, y'all said at the same time.
Take Me in Your Arms.
Take Me in Your Arms, okay. I can play Never
Thank
Go Over There.
Love you.
I'm doing. I love you too, Miss Kim. Oh, shoot. I just had it and lost it. Okay, here we go.
On high. there.